This is the Spa Retailer Podcast, where we talk retail, business, and all things related to the hot tub industry. I'm your host, Megan Kendrick, owner of Spa Retailer Magazine. Welcome to the Spa Retailer Podcast. I'm Megan. I am back again with Jim Van Fleet, one of the owners of Mainly Tubs. If you haven't listened to the last episode, please do, because this will be a continuation of that discussion. I've been talking to Jim about his employee stock ownership plan. Last episode, Jim, we talked about what an ESOP is and why you decided to do it. This time, I'd like to find out more details of your ESOP and how you set it up specifically for Mainly Tubs. What was kind of the beginning step of, you know, last time we talked about you got the valuation and the reasons behind, what was kind of the initial step to get the ESOP started?
Well, once I knew of the concept, Megan, I joined, there are a couple of national associations in the ESOP world. And I found the NCEO, the National Center for Employee Ownership. It's a San Francisco-based nonprofit membership organization. And the members are not just owners and practitioners of ESOPs, but banks and accountants and attorneys and all the people who, ultimate trustees, the people who are hired as the professional consultants in order to ensure that an ESOP is set up in a legal manner and makes sense from all the participants' perspective. So I joined this organization. I went to a couple of their annual conferences, and I found the other businesses in Maine who were ESOPs and went and started to visit with those folks just to start to do my homework and get a sense of how, not only structurally how it works, but what are the mechanics behind the scenes? How, once you have an ESOP, what has to happen? How do the employees understand the benefits and what's happening to their stock? How do they see and understand how their day-to-day activities affects their retirement? So there are a lot of nuts and bolts details that took me quite some time to understand well enough so I knew how to interview those folks who might be a trustee, who would be the people with whom I negotiate for the value of my business, negotiate against, if you will. But I have an opportunity to interview those people and at least designate somebody who looks like they're experienced in doing so. You have to interview if you feel as if you need your own consultant, valuation consultant. Many accounting firms do this. And there needs to be, for the trustee, a valuation company. There are also lawyers involved. I spend a lot of time interviewing many of these people so that by the time we started to get down to brass tacks and negotiate, I had hired my own lawyer. I had hired my own accountancy firm for my own valuation purposes. I then hired the trustee and they recommended to them who they should hire for a valuation firm. But I have to say that all of this, it takes time. There's a lot of detail to it. It is not a fall out of bed kind of a transaction. It's one that can be expensive. A lot of people object when you have to pay a few thousand dollars for any consultant. The cost of my ESOP ran well over $100,000 totally in lawyers' fees and trustees' fees and accountancy fees. But you remember, my company was also at the time running the next year over $10 million in sales, so we had a little more room for in our profit and loss statement to be able to pay for good consultants.
I imagine other retailers listening to this, you know, maybe they're their heart sinking a little bit when they hear you talk about how much time and effort and money it took to set this up. But I imagine
Well,
that.
I'll tell you, I think you're right. They might. But consider the alternative. How long does it take to train your kids to be able to know enough to run the business so that they can start to pay you a retirement income, which gives you something close to the market value that you made for this company or from a private buyer? So none of this comes easy. I think there's a life lesson here that you get what you pay for. This is not something that is going to be applicable to small businesses. Depends on how you define small, but if you can't meet the criteria that I mentioned earlier, then it's probably not going to be something for you.
Sure. So once you did all this background work and obtained this knowledge yourself and found all of the people that you wanted to be involved, is it a little weird to, like you said, basically hire someone to negotiate against? How does that work?
Yeah, it is a little weird, except that these people recognize that they have a fiduciary responsibility and that licenses that they get in order to be in this businesses are really important to them because they want to do a lot of transactions. So they have to, it's one thing to interview them and hire them, but once you've done that, they're entirely independent and you aren't necessarily going to like what they say or who they decide to hire or what their attorneys have to say. And there can be some, the negotiation to arrive at a price was fairly drawn out and took some time and took a lot of information providing and as good negotiations do, they don't just, you don't fall out of bed and find a negotiated price for a company that in our case was 5 or 6 times a multiple of EBITDA.
I guess so. Once you have worked with them and negotiated a price and figured out that part of it, what's the next step? At what point do you present this to your employees and have those details worked out for them?
Really good question, because part of the architecture of a deal includes trying to set up incentives, extra incentives I wanted for the key people in the business who I knew were going to ultimately take my place. And they already had their important functions. But they're the people in anybody's company who have the best ability to affect revenue growth and profitability. And within an ESOP, some people have heard the term of phantom stock or options or stock appreciation rights. Those are conventional terms in corporate finance. They're also terms that are used in an ESOP. And so part of what I wanted to do was to not just be able to have all the employees get annual distributions of stock and the stock value go up. I wanted incentives for the key players, in my case, stock appreciation rights, so that as the company performed really well, those people who were making it perform really well, who had management responsibility, would get extra incentives and ultimately pay for having done so. In the case of the underlying stock of the company itself, there's a 6-year vesting period once you get to a mandatory retirement age of 65, I think. And the same thing exists in a vesting period for the stock appreciation rights. So whether it's the stock or whether it's the stock appreciation rights, the idea was to ensure that people could see that they, once they did perform and make the company perform well, there were going to be several different ways in which they would be compensated.
So when you set this up and you clearly have existing employees and the vesting is at 6 years, does that start when the ESOP starts, or is it retroactive? So you've been here for 7 years, so your stock is already vested. Is that how that works?
No, it starts when the plan starts.
Okay.
So, and because I have a pretty young population, nobody was, I was the only person remotely close to retirement age. So the vesting period, I think, was less important as I chatted ultimately with employees about that. And you have to have key employees involved pretty much from the outset, Megan. It's not something that I could do independently. The trustee, using the Department of Labor regulations, has to be able to interview the key members of management to ensure that the representations that are being made about future finances, what kind of revenue can we expect in the future and why, and what kind of expenses will we have in the future, it required us to do forward-looking 5 and 10-year budgets. And that's a rigorous process in itself. But that process that includes key managers means that there is more than just the owner involved in setting the future direction. And that's why the trustee wants to talk to key managers. So the long and the short of it is, I was required to bring key managers into the confidential process so that, one, they could understand from their own standpoint how and we were going to manage the company going forward, but also so they could eventually be interviewed by independent outside folks who needed to satisfy themselves and ultimately the Department of Labor that this company would run without the selling shareholder. Now, it wasn't envisioned that I was the selling shareholder. It wasn't envisioned that I was going to go right away, leave right away. But at 69, anything can happen. And the trustee has to protect all the employees. And so they have to be sure that if something happened to me, that the company was going to continue to run. And that's really important. That's what makes a good company in the first place. I learned several years back that the more time off I took and the company continued to perform as well as it had, the more valuable my company is. My wife liked that too, I might say.
I'm
Oh,
sure
you
she
can work
did.
less? You can work less and your company's worth more? So. But that's what happens in the eyes of valuation people who want to understand and have to protect all of the employees to ensure that the company will continue to run in perpetuity. And this retirement plan can, in fact, be a retirement plan.
When did it officially take effect then?
All of the it took effect on 12/31, 16, so the end of last year, so that all of the existing employees who had worked 1,000 hours got their first year of vesting in 2016. And that's just the nature of the way I chose to do it. It made sense to do it at the close of a fiscal year. We had to put in place things that we hadn't done before. There has to be an outside independent auditor who looks at the financial statements and says to the trustee, yes, these financials are. They are accurate representation of what's going on in this company. And then the trustee can say, okay, well, that means that the stock price this year is. And in a good performing company, of course, the expectation is that the stock price will continue to expand over time. There are some inside loans that are involved in an ESOP, which are complicating, but the long and the short of it is that I chose a period over 25 years to distribute 100% of the stock to employees. And I did that because I wanted new employees over time to have plenty of opportunity to get portions of the company's ownership. And if you distribute 100% of the shares in a short term to generally young employees who enjoy working, there's going to be nothing left for the new people who come in. So there are some conscious planning criteria that you have to think about in order to put something like this in place and to ensure that it's going to be enjoyed and all the incentives are going to be enjoyed by all of the employees over time. I chose not to do this with my own personal tax calculation as an important variable.
Okay.
That may sound anti-American, but I was an S-Corp and had been an S-Corp all along from a structural standpoint. If I had changed to a C-Corp, I could have done what's called a 1042 exchange, which basically was avoid all of the capital gains on the stock that I was selling to the ESOP. That might prove very attractive to some people, but what it does is it requires the successor company, once the transaction happens — this is sort of arcane, but it requires the successor company to be a C corporation for at least 5 years. That then requires the C corporation to pay taxes before it can even pay a bank that might be involved or the shareholder who is taking financing back. So in my case, I chose to not have that be my motivation, rather to choose to pay capital gains on an installment basis as how I would handle the taxes of my own personal situation. And that will give the company far more cash to run itself because it's not having to pay taxes on a going forward basis. The only taxes that ultimately are paid by an ESOP are by the participants when they get their stock many years out, and only on a regular income tax basis at whatever rates they happen to have. So I chose not to get to take advantage of what might have saved a lot of cash for me in order to ensure the ultimate success of the ESOP going forward.
Say hello to SpaBot, the world's first hands-free automatic spa cleaner. Cleaning a hot tub has never been easier than with the Polaris SpaBot robotic cleaner. This first ever automatic spa cleaner introduces special spa nav technology designed to maneuver around the small, confined spaces typical of in-ground spas and portable hot tubs. Providing the ultimate hands-free convenience of automated cleaning, SpaBot is completely cordless and cleans in just 60 minutes. Learn more at polarispool.com. So explain what happens when you do decide to retire and leave the business. What happens to your stocks? What happens to the employees? Who's in charge now? How does that work?
Yeah. Well, there's a board of directors. Good question. I had to agree to cede control of the company to a board of directors. And it's a board in which I'm allowed to serve as a director, but I have to have two outside independent directors who ultimately are responsible as a group to manage the company going forward, to choose who they hire for staff, to approve, just like a normal corporation would, all of the sort of underpinnings operationally of any company. And the trustee appoints the board. So I had a chance to recommend a slate of directors, but at the end of the day, the trustee had the say as to who were going to be the directors for the company. And as contractual CEO, which is what I am for at least a 3-year period, I have to report to that board of directors. I can still be a member and am of the board, but I'm a minority. I'm a minority, one of three in our case. And so I basically had to agree to be accountable to somebody other than myself. And that's a change. But that's okay. You know, we had already set up as a management group the idea that that could happen with time. So that's an interesting format change for a company which has been led by an entrepreneur, as many in our industry are. You have to be ready and willing to think hard about how you're going to govern yourselves going forward.
So were those directors people, current employees, or are they people outside of the business, or a combination of both? Where did they come from?
They're outside people. One is a person, acquaintance that I have known for many years, who's a really successful businessman who I think would provide some extraordinary value on a board. The other is was the CEO of another ESOP company. So there's another ESOP company in Maine of fairly significant size, and I got to know this guy as I was doing my research. And so he's been through all the rigors of ESOPs, knows all of the landmines, if you will, and how to be successful at operating it. And so I asked him, and I was lucky enough to that both of these guys with substantial business experience in industries other than my own would accept their board seats. They get paid for this. There's, you know, it's like any other board. You have to pay to get this kind of knowledge and expertise, and that's part of the ongoing expense of an ESOP, which people ask me all the time, what's it cost on an annual going forward basis to run an ESOP? And my answer is, well, probably a minimum of 30,000, and you might get a high of 60 or 65,000 for the combination of all the people who have to be on board in order to run it well and comply with the Department of Labor's ERISA standards.
So the board, what decisions are they involved in? Are they only involved in the management of the ESOP? I mean, I imagine they're not involved in daily operations of the company. Where do sort of their responsibilities lie?
Yeah, their responsibilities do lie with the operations of the company, because it's the trustee who's responsible for the reporting of and the oversight of the ESOP. But so they're approving, take an example, they're approving budgets. They're getting quarterly reports on the financial results of our company compared to budget and compared to last year. They're monitoring what I call key performance indices, which are what are important touchstone points in determining on an ongoing basis how well we're doing, you know, unit sales versus plan, unit sales versus last year, gross margins, and a lot of key things. But so their real job is to hire and fire the CEO and ensure that the CEO continues to have staff and functionaries who are able to run the company, grow it, meet objectives. These board members must also serve as an audit committee, as a compensation committee. So those kinds of activities are now out of the hands of the owner and the owner staff, and rather in the hands of professionals.
Has it been difficult for you to turn over some of that control? I mean, I know you decided to do this, so you knew it was coming, but has that been an uncomfortable thing for you to do?
Not particularly, just by dint of age, if nothing else. There has to come a time when you give it up.
Sure.
But it's kind of a new twist, and I think it's important for younger people, my staff included, to see and be part of a company that's run by independent directors. That's what 99% of all employers are anyway. For me, it's been fun. The whole thing has been fun. It's been a lot of work, more work than I expected. I had to give up rounds of golf that I would ordinarily play in order to get this done.
Well, I was going to ask if you'd found this to be sort of an energizing and I guess a fun process. I mean, I know it does sound like it's been a lot of work, but I mean, imagine it gave you something completely new to tackle and to learn about. And sometimes that can be a really motivating and energizing thing to do.
Well, you know, I was sort of gradually evolving myself into work less over the years, just because I couldn't work as much as I used to work. But it allowed me to kind of become something I never had thought about before. I call myself the Walmart greeter now, and I'm not in the store 7 days a week anymore, of course. But whenever there are lots of traffic, I'm in, and I love being in and telling people about the success of our company, and that now all the employees own it, and isn't a wonderful part of Americans' capitalism that we can have a system in which the people who helped grow a company can become owners. That's very exciting. And, you know, that's not routine either. I think it's exciting stuff. And for anybody in our industry, I think we're in a pretty fun industry anyway. We're not a pool company. We're just a hot tub company. But, we're in the wellness business. We're in the fun business. We're in the therapy business. I even call my hot tub my think tank.
Is that where you decided to came up with the idea to do an ESOP, was in your hot tub?
in my think tank.
What has been your employees' reaction to this? Do they understand what this means for them? Are they excited about it? What has been their reaction to having this set up for them?
Logically, their first response is, what is this?
Right.
What is an ESOP? And I told the story at our holiday party, which is when I told everybody what was happening. I'd just come from the closing, and all the paperwork was done in the middle of December. The transaction was effective, and all the money stuff happened on the 30th of the year. But I told them at the Christmas holiday party that I'd just come from a closing at which I'd sold the business. And I didn't talk for about 10 seconds, and everybody's jaws dropped, and they looked around, and they said, oh, my God, what's happened? And I said, and now I'd like to introduce you to the new owners of Mainly Tubbs. I'd like you to look to your left and look to your right, because all of you have now been gifted in your retirement plans the ownership of this company. And so none of the employees had to put up any money in order to allow this to be put in place. But you've heard some of the rigors of what it means to be an ESOP going forward. And they were all really excited. They were particularly excited when I told them the story of another ESOP company in which a retiree had gotten up to speak at his retirement party and said, 25 years ago, when you guys put this in place, I thought it was a lot of baloney. I thought it was some way you were lining your pockets. And I'm standing up here today with a retirement check that's worth $500,000. And I've been a laborer for 25 years in this company. And so this is no bunk. So I told that story to everybody, and that sort of helped get people get over the idea that this was some highfalutin transaction. It's a real transaction in which people ultimately are going to gain based on how well they do and how well they continue to run the company. They're going to gain something of significant value in their retirement that they would not otherwise get elsewhere. So I think that gives us a leg up as the employer. That's one of the reasons that I liked it. Good stuff.
It sounds like, you already had great people in place who were doing a wonderful job. But I mean, have you seen a change in their attitude at all now that they are, part owners of the company? Has there been a shift in their own personal motivations that you've seen?
It's been in place for 4 months now. Clearly the management staff is very excited. They know much more about it than the rank and file.
Of course.
The rank and file seems to be excited because they know that nothing is going to change. Their jobs are going to be protected and they're going to get some future benefit. And if they do well, their pay will go up, their bonuses will go up, and they'll also have a stock that continues to grow in value. So I think they all get the idea that in this day and age as a company that we have to be really good at customer interactions. You know, customers hold this a torch to our feet every day, which is the ability to post on the internet anything which is a less than satisfactory experience with any company's representatives. And so it really heightens the importance to be really good with people after the sale. And that's been the hallmark of our success. And I think everybody recognizes that. All our employees are paying a lot more attention to, or at least they tell me about, the happy interactions they have with customers, and that they can tell customers that they're part owners in the company. It leads to a fun conversation. And I like to think that over time, as they get to learn more about it and they start to see statements representing the value in their retirement accounts of the company stock, that will also continue to energize them.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all of this with us. I really appreciate your willingness to kind of go on the record and explain this in so much detail. Succession planning is a topic that retailers have expressed a lot of interest in over the years, and I'm so excited that we can share your unique plan so that others can learn from what you've been doing. It's really been great and interesting, so thank you so much.
You're so welcome, Megan. Nice to chat with you. People know how to reach out to me. I welcome the opportunity to answer questions.
Yeah.
Have a chance.
I was going to say, you know, if anyone does have questions for Jim on this topic or for me, you know, you can email us at podcast@spa-retailer.com. You know, if we have enough questions, we can even do a follow-up where we answer some of those. So please let us know. We're, as Jim has already said, he's happy to answer all of your questions. So we welcome those at any time.
I haven't set up a consulting company yet, Megan, but
you may have to after this.
I don't know. You know, there are a lot of baby boomers who own. I'm clearly at my age, a baby boomer. And there are a lot of us who own companies like this who want to find nifty ways to ramp out of a business as opposed to fall out of a business.
The industry is kind of at that point where there are these entrepreneurs who have started these businesses and who are kind of ready to move on, whether it's to something new or to retirement. And so there are a lot of people out there who are at the place where you are and are looking for those answers. So, which is why this has been such a popular topic in the past. And I'm excited to bring more on this topic coming in later episodes. So stay tuned. We will continue to talk about succession planning. If there's a particular aspect you'd like to hear more about, please let us know.
The Spa Retailer Podcast is a production of Spa Retailer Magazine. Let us know what you think by leaving a review or emailing us at podcast@spa-retailer.com. Thanks for listening.